This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Sandra Day O'Connor made American history when in 1981 she was appointed by President Ronald Reagan as the first woman Supreme Court justice. But her days of breaking ground preceded her joining the nation's highest court. O'Connor was a powerful lawmaker in her native Arizona, rising to become the first woman to serve as majority leader of any state legislative chamber when the Republican became leader in the state Senate. Justice O'Connor bucked traditional norms even as a law student and lawyer, defying the suggestion that women were expected to become homemakers. Her story and her tenure on the Supreme Court are explored in the new installment of the PBS anthology series American Experience. I spoke earlier with the writer, director of Sandra Day O'Connor, the first. Here is our recorded conversation. Joining us now is Michelle Ferrari, writer, director, and producer of American Experience, Sandra Day O'Connor, the first. It appears tonight on PBS stations. Michelle, thank you so much for coming back on our program.
Thanks for having me back.
It's our pleasure to have you back. And I was really fascinated by the story of Sandra Day O'Connor, so much of her life that I didn't know, mainly that she wasn't just a trailblazer in being the first woman appointed to the United States Supreme Court. She pretty much was a trailblazer her whole life. And one quick anecdote in this story was she changed a tire when she was 14 years old. They describe Arizona, where she was growing up, as this frontier area in that period of time. And she was one, like kids were expected to do, helping out around the house and on the projects outside, and had to change a tire. And she went and told her dad because she was so proud of herself, "I changed the tire by myself." And his response to her was, "You're late, leave earlier." Can you talk a little bit about how she was a trailblazer even very early in her life?
I think everything about her childhood encouraged a sense of independence and a sense of responsibility. She grew up on a 160,000-acre cattle ranch, and there were no other kids around for the first 8 years of her life. It was just her and her parents and the ranch hands. And her earliest friends, apart from the animals on the ranch, were the ranch hands. So she learned a lot of poise because she was dealing primarily with adults. And I think that, she, from that background, it instilled in her a sense of that she was responsible for whatever happened, and that the job wasn't finished until it was finished.
And she had her mindset that when it was time to get a higher education, that she was going to study law, and did that at Stanford. And this was not a period of history in which women were really expected to go into that line of work. You know, you could be a teacher, you could be a nurse, but a woman attorney was very rare. What inspired her to pursue that in spite of that obstacle?
She always credited one of her professors at Stanford, who was an attorney himself, although he didn't teach law. And he really he taught her that women could change the world, that women should take their place alongside men and men should let them. And I think she was fascinated by the prospect of being able to change the world through the law. And she didn't really consider the fact that she would have a very difficult time. It was impossible, actually, for her to find a position in a private firm. Private firms really did not hire women in the early 1950s when she graduated from Stanford Law. And so she wound up going into the public sector.
She had found a firm or a man who hired a woman, and she specifically sought this man out because of that hiring that he had made previously. He said that he had no place for her, and she was so eager to work that she said, "Please just sit me next to the secretary, and I'll work for free if the secretary will have me while we figure this out." What does that say about her early tenacity?
Well, I think, the first thing it says is that she wasn't in a position where she had to earn a living. She was married and her husband made a good salary, although he too was starting out, and there was some money in her family. And so she was able to say to this district attorney, "I'm happy to work for free." at least to start. And she was willing to do whatever it took to get her foot in the door, because she believed that once you get the foot in the door and you have an opportunity, then you put on a good show and you show people that women can do a good job and they'll give you more jobs.
It was important to note that she had a supportive partner when she met John O'Connor at Stanford. She married him in 1952, and he's obviously alive in this era as well, where men are highly favored and women have more obstacles to overcome. How significant was his perspective of his own spouse in that period of time and his support of her own endeavors and her own dreams? How important was that?
I think it was absolutely crucial. I mean, I think, you know, John and Sandra O'Connor had a true love relationship, and he really understood his wife's gifts and talents and supported her in whatever she wanted to do, to the point where when she was nominated to the court or confirmed for to the court, he really, you know, put her career ahead of his own and gave up his job in Arizona and went east with her to Washington, D.C.
He had a successful practice of his own in Arizona and decided, you know, without hesitation that they would relocate to the Washington, D.C. area so that she could assume her role on the Supreme Court. We're going to get to that significance of her appointment to the Supreme Court. But again, I don't think I ever knew that, one, she was a state lawmaker in Arizona, and also that she was the first woman to lead a state legislative branch. I mean, she was head of the Senate there in Arizona. And that seemed to be based on the film, Michelle, where she learned how to navigate in political circles, being a woman while still accomplishing things in a male-dominated world. Am I right in that perspective?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think, you know, she had a lot of charm and social intelligence even before she got to the legislature, to the Senate in Arizona. One of her biographers, Linda Hirschman, says she was a girl's girl and a man's man. She was really able to get along with other people. But as you say, in the Senate, she learned how to parlay that social intelligence into getting things done, and really demonstrated a knack for negotiation and building compromise.
In particular, the Equal Rights Amendment, and that would have benefited women greatly in that period. And there was a challenge in Arizona to get a sweeping piece of legislation related to women's rights passed. And so she seemed to accept that challenge and that defeat, and instead managed to maneuver through a lot of single pieces of legislation that comprehensively almost accomplished the same deal.
That's true. She didn't want to stake her political capital on the Equal Rights Amendment, which was facing a lot of opposition within her own caucus even. And so instead, she just took it upon herself to examine the laws in Arizona, pluck out anything that was unfavorable to women, and, you know, cast them as second-class citizens, and she just methodically went about changing every single one of those laws.
We're talking with Michelle Ferrari, the writer, director, and producer of the new installment of American Experience on PBS, Sandra Day O'Connor, the First. Obviously, it's about the first woman appointed to the United States Supreme Court. It premieres tonight on PBS stations across the country. You mentioned her charm and her social experience. And that was significant when Ronald Reagan nominated her to the nation's highest court, because she had to come to Washington and start to talk to some of the people who would be voting on her, the men of the United States Senate. And she faced an additional challenge in not just being a woman, but she had also never heard a federal case. After serving in the state Senate in Arizona, she served in the state courts there. And it's unusual for someone to elevate from state courts to the Supreme Court without serving on some lower federal branch of the judiciary. How did she navigate that particular challenge?
Well, I mean, she did what she always does, which is to say she prepared In advance of that trip to Washington, where she met with senators, she really crammed a lot of information and spent a lot of time, you know, anticipating what kind of questions would be asked, not only by the senators in those informal meetings, but certainly during the confirmation meetings. Once she was on the bench, she estimated that she read about 1,000 pages a day.
And then she's nominated. This is something that Ronald Reagan made a campaign vow to do, to nominate a woman in his first opportunity to appoint someone to the Supreme Court. And this announcement from Reagan followed his vocal opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. This had started to change in the Republican Party, where the party had started to be dominated by the far right flank. The religious evangelicals were starting to come into power at that point in time in the Republican Party. And so here he is, someone who took a vocal opposition against a piece of legislation that would have benefited women, but made a vow to nominate a woman. I'm wondering, I know this is not a film about Ronald Reagan, but was that significant for him in his ascension to the presidency and maybe gaining the support of women that ultimately led to the opportunity for O'Connor?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, as we talk about in the film, she was really meant to be a symbol. She was a gesture to college-educated women for whom the Republican Party's new stance against equal rights, against abortion rights, was somewhat something less than appealing. And so nominating Sandra Day O'Connor to the court was a way of saying to those women, we're interested in your causes, even if it doesn't seem from our platform that we are. This was a big shift in the Republican Party. I found this on The Vote also. You know, the parties recalibrate periodically. And so we don't tend to think of the Republican Party as being in favor of women's rights or abortion rights. But until 1980 and Ronald Reagan's election, they were, in fact, very much in favor of those things, or at least they were a party of many views on those issues. And the Republican Party was, in fact, the first political party to endorse the Equal Rights Amendment.
And in that period, just to build upon the point you just made about the way that the parties shift, the Roe v. Wade decision came in 1973, which established a federal right to abortion, and it was the law of the land. Sandra Day O'Connor was nominated to the Supreme Court when Ronald Reagan became president in 1981, and so she was facing questions in the United States Senate from those who would be voting on her nomination about abortion specifically. And it struck me as particularly interesting because today we expect questions about abortion anytime anyone is nominated to the Supreme Court. But I believe it was John Paul Stevens who was nominated just a few years prior by Jimmy Carter, prior to O'Connor's ascension to the Supreme Court, and he didn't receive a single question about abortion. So how quick was this shift on that particular issue then?
I think it was very quick, although I will say in 1980, the ideological fault lines had not hardened. So Sandra Day O'Connor was able to deflect those questions about abortion and was unanimously confirmed.
She was unanimously confirmed, and there was a clip used in the film. Then Senator Joe Biden saying, "I think you're going to make a great justice. I'm going to vote for you, but I'm struck by the fact you haven't answered a single question." So she does make it onto the court, of course. And I should note, John Paul Stevens was also approved unanimously. So just to show you how far removed we are from that period of time, you don't see that much anymore. How do you describe her role on the court as the first woman? I know that in the film, you explore this brief moment where an attorney arguing before the court was interrupted by Justice O'Connor and said, "Hold on, let me finish." Something very unusual in the Supreme Court.
She definitely was faced with a great many challenges as the first woman, not only the scene that you describe where she gets talked over, and as you noted, that is absolutely not how Supreme Court practice works. But she got a memo from the Chief Justice And in the memo was an article, a psychological study about how a woman should behave when she is, the lone woman in a field of powerful men. And the study concluded that the woman should be passive. And I think, O'Connor was dismayed by receiving this memo, but she didn't react to it. She filed it away and just put her head down and did her best, which her best is always great,
Obviously, this film explores her years on the Supreme Court, her battle with breast cancer in the late 1980s, and more about her life. It's a really well done film. I learned a lot from it. I'm wondering, based on the work you did on this project, where does Sandra Day O'Connor fit in the minds of women today, or where should she fit as inspiration for women today?
Well, certainly part of Justice O'Connor's story is about shattering the glass ceiling. And in some ways, she's a pretty unlikely protagonist in that story, insofar as she was not exactly a robust champion of women's rights. She kind of played defense, I would say. But I think what's almost more interesting to me about her is that shattering of the glass ceiling story is really just the first chapter, right? And at some juncture, and I'd argue it's even before Ruth Bader Ginsburg joined the court, Justice O'Connor's story is no longer about being the first. It's about her style as a justice on the bench. And I was really intrigued by that style, by her vision of the court in American life and the court's role, and her gift for building consensus, which I increasingly seems to me, anyway, a lost art.
Michelle Ferrari is the writer, director, and producer of the new installment of American Experience, Sandra Day O'Connor, The First. It premieres tonight on PBS stations across the country, including here locally. Michelle, congratulations on this latest film you've done, and I appreciate the time you gave us to talk about it.
Thank you so much, Michael.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.